Let's get started. Welcome to the final meeting of Modern World Literatures in 2013-14. As previously advertised, this is going to be a roundtable discussion of China Mieville's novel, The City and the City. And for once, it's not you guys who are in the spotlight, but us. We, your tutors, will discuss the book for roughly half an hour or so, and then open it up to questions from you. So have those questions at the ready. I'm sure you've been thinking about them for most of the term. And hopefully we will touch on some aspects of this book, but also questions of genre, questions of geography and geopolitics, and of the form of modern world literature that is relevant to what we've been doing throughout the year. We used to have China Mieville, if not live, at least in simulcast with us for this discussion via Skype, but unfortunately he's so busy and famous these days that we couldn't manage to schedule him in. However, there are ways of funneling this discussion back to China. So if there's specific questions that you'd like to pose to the author, don't hesitate to bring those questions to me at a later date. And hopefully in seminars, you'll be able to continually develop the themes that we've touched on in this discussion today. So thanks for coming. And also thanks to our tutors. Perhaps we should just give the tutors a round of applause. Because they've been doing a great job this year, I know. Okay, this novel, like Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, is a work that that deviates from the expected format of literary writing. That is to say, it is an example of genre fiction. In this case, genre fiction in two senses, at least, in that it is both what China Mieville is best known for, an example of weird fiction or speculative fiction, or in some terms, fantasy, sci-fi fiction. And it is also a hard-boiled detective novel, so-called police procedural. And in bringing those two genres together, with its premise, it opens up possibilities that we wouldn't otherwise necessarily see highlighted in this way. I want to just, in a few introductory remarks, touch on some of the things that I think are important in discussing this novel, and then we'll open it up to the tutors to have something to say in turn, and we'll discuss the novel amongst ourselves, and then open it up to you. So, as with much genre fiction, The City and the City depends on how it develops its premise. The premise drives a great deal of the logic of the novel. And this premise is extraordinarily interesting from the point of view of world literature because of the way that it both does and does not touch on the realities of our urban and geopolitical moment. We have two coextensive yet mutually invisible cities in this work. They're cities that are made up of discrepant and often unrecognized alternate realities, defined by borders of nationality, but in ways that we can recognize as extending to other borders as well. Class, race, religion, gender, and so forth. So we want to think about ways in which this fertile metaphor, the metaphor of two cities coexisting in the same space, works not just as a simple one-to-one allegory for a real life or real history situation, but can be extended and expanded and ramifies in different ways, different forms. Think about borders for a minute. Think about the cities that we know, IRL, constitute some kind of conjunction. Budapest, for example, made up of two cities across the river, Buda and Pest. Minneapolis-St. Paul in my own United States of America, which are known as the Twin Cities. But then think of divided or partitioned cities, cities like Jerusalem and Lebanon and Belfast during the period of the Troubles. Cold War Berlin and also Cold War Vienna, as portrayed in the great noir Cold War thriller, The Third Man, which is, I think, an interesting intertext for Mabel's novel. Think about two cities that are straddled borders, like El Paso and Ciudad Juarez in the south of the United States and the north of Mexico. These two cities are conjoined and yet represent drastically different realities for their inhabitants. Think about Istanbul, which spans two continents, Europe and Asia. And then think also about cities within cities, a city like the Vatican City, where the Pope presides within the larger city of metropolitan Rome. Within this premise, Mabel is developing a logic, but the logic doesn't necessarily play out, as I said, in one direction. It's interesting to see how these strategies of unseeing that the citizens of Bejel and El Coma adopt don't hold absolutely. We might want to think about what strategies of unseeing really involve. How is it that we're able to see things and not see things in everyday life? What would be the strategy of unseeing that would pertain to the places that you live, for example? We also want to talk about genre. As I said, these are two genres fused in ways that open up productive possibilities that would not obtain, perhaps, to either one of them in isolation. But we also want to think about what I've referred to as the institutional authority of the literary apparatus, the way in which cultural prestige is given to certain kinds of writing but not to others. This is, of course, not a steady state or fixed state of affairs. China Mabel has won many awards in the sci-fi realm, but is now beginning to be known in the worlds of literary fiction as well. And because he has a PhD in international law and is a noted Trotskyist in his politics, he has a different kind of identity in those realms as well. It's interesting to think, I think, about the implications of sci-fi or fantasy as a genre for literary fiction, because it raises this question that we've been looking at all year, and that's the question of realism. What does it mean for writing to tell us the story of things as they are versus making things up? And why is it that certain forms of fiction are able to provide us a realist optic in ways that nonfiction or naturalist modes of narration might not necessarily do as well at doing. So sci-fi is not simply to be opposed in this sense with realist writing. In some ways, this is a highly realist text. Finally, world lit and world lit echoes. I'm sure you guys have recognized some forms of connection between the city and the city in some of the works that we've been reading throughout this year. But it's also true that this city, that this novel participates in a cultural context that has to do as much with television, to do with movies, even to do with online and video gaming forms of representation as it does with so-called straight literary fiction. How many people have seen The Killing, the TV series? Yeah, a few of you. So it was originally a Danish TV show that was then remade, not so well, has to be said, in the American context. One of the TV shows that sparked a renaissance, a dramatic rise in interest in Scandinavian noir, Scandinavian detective fiction. Henny Mankell and Stieg Larsson are perhaps two of the best-known practitioners. But really, I think Mabel is as much indebted to the hard-boiled and what you might call the social detective novel that extends back to Raymond Chandler, but also to such practitioners as Sarah Paretsky with her V.I. Warshawski series set in Chicago, which is an excellent example of this kind of realist genre fiction that I've been talking about. So think about the question of world literature and think about the question of translation itself. How do we come to know the situation in this book through the translation medium of our narrator, Inspector Theodor Bolu, and what's involved in that kind of translation process. Okay, so just by way of opening remarks, but now we'll all say something about the book and have a little bit of a mini discussion before turning it over to you.
Yeah, do you want me to begin?
Yeah,
okay.
Please.
I wondered if we might think about how Mievel is using archaeology and excavation in this novel. I think it's quite significant because the exploitation of these historical artifacts that Mahalia's mixed up in is what leads to her death, and then she's killed using one of these precursor artifacts. And I thought maybe we could think about the way that they, I mean, excavation as a part of kind of detective fiction anyway, but also I thought we could think about the way that these things exist kind of cross-temporally, kind of they're things from the past and the excavator brings them into the present. And maybe that as a kind of analogue to the kind of double inhabitation of space that's happening in the novel. And I also wondered what everyone made of the kind of inexplicable nature of the material culture of the precursor period, because Professor Nancy says that, you know, these are things which display a high level of kind of decorative artistic work, and but they're also really crude things, and they kind of seem to erase a notion of progress or kind of development when they're uncovered.
Exactly, yeah, there's a great quote that supports that point. This material culture, says Mahalia's advisor, makes no sense at all. There's nowhere else in the world that you'll dig up what looks like cutting-edge late antiquity, really beautiful, complicated bronze work mixed right up with, frankly, Neolithic stuff. It's an interesting image of juxtaposed strata of so-called civilization or history. And what he says brings up this question of what constitutes progress.
Okay. Well, Nick was talking about the importance of the premise. So I'm interested in the way that the premise is realized through language. So myself and us have been talking about the multiplicity of language, the way in which it has multi-voicedness, and also the way in which language carries with it certain kind of social connotations or picks them up, which depends both on who is speaking and who is listening. So Bakhtin talks about these kinds of issues in his theories on polyphony, dialogism, and heteroglossia. And he talks about a combination of speech genres. Now, a speech genre might be anything from journalistic, might be a speech genre, intellectual might be a speech genre. So we can kind of see this coming through in the novel. Really, obviously, I mean, it's kind of performative in the fact that you have Illitan and you have Bege and you have English, but then you also have Corvi, who kind of speaks in this kind of working class and she swears a lot. Then you have the academics and they talk in kind of academic vernacular. Then you have the kind of police jargon and all these different ways of speaking and all the cultural contrasts that come with them serve to kind of reinforce the social strata and reinforce the premise, which is all about boundaries and transgressing boundaries. And one of the ways in which you can transgress boundaries in this novel is by speaking a language in a city which you shouldn't be speaking it in, and that becomes a kind of transgressive act. So I just want to think about the way in which Mievel uses language to fulfill his premise.
I was wondering whether we could think for a while about the form of the novel here, because from the beginning of the year we have been discussing the form of the novel, especially in Pablo's lecture on Conrad's heart, Heart of Darkness, it turned out quite obviously. So here I was wondering whether we could think whether allegory has some kind of a relationship to the changing model production or the changing economic structures at the particular period of time. Because in from the 1980s onwards, with the rise of finance capitalism, actually the cities has turned into such places where the power or the forces of domination not necessarily exist within that particular place. So actually our local environments are in a way under the force of other global power relations. So here, when we see those two cities and the bridge in between, and which is really determining what the laws or legislation or what should be seen or unseen in those two cities. What kind of an analogy of this, of our own cities or the cities that we are living in, or the globe, the way it's ruled at the moment in a way. So I would love to discuss in my seminars about the form and its relation to allegory, and how does it represent our current economic situation.
Okay, another quotation that supports this interest is has to do with the way in which the situation in Beja and Okoma is represented not as a one-to-one allegory mapping onto our understanding of history and this world, but more a sense in which it captures an underlying logic. And this is a logic that I, in some ways, is been a red thread running throughout the entire year, and that's the logic of what is called combined and uneven development, the way in which progress is not necessarily uniform. The way that it produces unevenness in certain spaces is part of the mechanism of progress itself. Progress conceived as a kind of modernizing narrative, that is. So, for example, the wonderful invention that Mabel has of the Doppler Café, where there's a café that serves the inhabitants of both cities, or both of two ethnicities, one Muslim and one Jewish. They're rented side by side, each with its own counter, halal on one side, kosher on the other, sharing a single name. The dividing wall is removed, a potent symbol, surely. But, ends Borlu with his little description, whether the Doppler Café was one establishment or two depended on who was asking. To a property tax collector, it was always one. When the taxman calls, the Doppler aspect fades out of sight. But this question of what's uneven in the city landscape, both within each city, but also across the city divide, is one that's sort of persistent in the way that the novel proceeds.
Okay, I'd like to build on Nesrin's points and Nick's points. I'm going to talk about the detective fiction genre, which this novel obviously draws on. So I'm going to try to historicize this a bit and link this to Victorian detective fiction in the 19th century. So I'm assuming most of you guys are familiar with the Sherlock Holmes stories, right? So in one of these stories, in The Man with the Twisted Lip, how many of you have read The Man with the Twisted Lip? Okay. Well, anyway.
Is that Benedict Cumberbatch?
I've not actually watched the TV series. Anyway, so in The Man with the Twisted Lip, so what happens here is that capitalism creates a lot of transgressions in the city, and Holmes' job as the detective is to rationalize the city, to put things back into order, to redraw boundaries. So what happens in The Man with the Twisted Lip is that Holmes puts an end to Mr. Neville St. Clair's doubling, so he pretends to be a beggar in the city, and that's actually where he gets his income from. But he's supposed to be a middle-class gentleman. So you can see the kind of doubling that's going on there. But Holmes discovers that he's doing this, and he puts an end to it. So he redraws social boundaries. And so that's how he helps the city to regain its order. But in order for him to do that, he actually has to be able to make connections between the different parts of the city. So Holmes, as a detective, has to be able to transgress boundaries in the city in order to see that these transgressions are taking place and then to stop these transgressions. So the same thing is actually going on in The City and the City with Borlu as a detective figure. Borlu is unable to solve the case when he's in either Bezel or in Okoma, but when he starts to work with Breach, he's able to see how the different parts of the city are connected together, right? And that enables him to solve the case. So there are examples of this. For example, on page 370, here Boileau is walking with his partner Achille from Breach, and he says, "Achille and I went by tram, by metro, by bus, by taxi, we walked. He treated us like a suture in and out of Basel and Ulcoma." So here, in walking through the city, the two characters are actually piecing together the different parts of the city, which inhabitants of both cities are not able to see because they have to unsee the other city. Okay, so when Boileau does this, when he's able to see the connections between the two cities, he's actually engaging in what Frederick Jameson calls a process of cognitive mapping. So he's able to make connections between different parts of the city and people in the different parts of the city. So in that sense, Boileau seems to represent a kind of a reader who's able to read a text and through reading the text, make connections between different geographical, social, national spaces around the world. And these connections are very often hidden. So you need to be like a detective, you need to excavate, as Mary said, and find out what these hidden connections are. Okay, but at the same time, although there are these similarities between Victorian detective fiction or even Gothic fiction, Jekyll and Hyde, The City and the City, I would like to also alert you guys to the differences, because in Victorian detective fiction and in Gothic fiction, the self-other binary is very obvious. It's a mannequin dichotomy, black and white. And whereas in The City and the City, Ulcoma and Basel are not exactly locked into that kind of self-other dynamic, right? It's not a first world, third world, center, periphery, self-other kind of clear-cut mannequin hierarchy. So I'd like you guys to think about how the two cities are different but also similar, and how the text suggests connections between these two cities that refuse that kind of dichotomous reading of power relations in the world.
Great, thank you.
Me?
Jack.
Okay. I'm conscious of our time, so perhaps I'll do something that's a little inclusive. I was initially going to pick a fight with Dr. Smith. I had a disagreement on the subject of breach, the role of breach in the novel. One of the arguments I put forward was that breach can be read as representative of an authoritarian power that derives its influence, that derives its authority from a willingness, from a consent, a consensus that is drawn from the people. There isn't really any reason why people in Ulcoma or people in Basel can't freely move between the two cities. There's only a kind of acknowledgement that this this is a hard and fast rule, and it is policed by breach. And of course, breach, as we later find, spoiler warning for everyone, who hasn't quite got to that point yet, breach, as we later find, are a disempowered organization whose efficacy rests on a certain narrative of power. So it's simply the story of Breach's power that allows what is an underfunded and small coterie of political agents to exert this tremendous influence over so many people. So my argument that I was presenting to Dr. Smith earlier on was that it's only this social contract, if you like, this agreement between the rulers and the ruled that allow breach and the separation of the cities to continue. We see symbolic transgressions in the detritus that sweeps through the street heedless of the parameters that have been imposed on the cityscape. Animals which breach willy-nilly, left, right and centre, breaking the rules. And for me, therefore, breach can be read as a representation of state power, state control, something that where the authority is derived from consent, which may or may not be consciously present, may or may not be derived from agents. Now, Christian, I know, Dr. Smith, has a different take on breach. I was wondering if you wanted to pitch your breach reading, and then we can maybe
Not going against each other.
We could have a breach about the breach.
There we go.
Okay,
so Georg Hegel wrote a book called The Phenomenology of Geist, Phenomenology of Spirit, in which he's working consciousness through its development, through its maturation. Consciousness is going to become, is going to begin at one point, and then it's going to move to the opposite point. As it moves back and forth between the two points, one of the things that consciousness realizes is that it can step back from those two points and see those two points using a critical analysis. and the whole history of 18th to 19th century German philosophy, which is one of the main threads of philosophy, is this move into critical consciousness. This is what's going on in this book. We begin in Betzel. We've got one point, one city, one set of limitations. Then our protagonist, who is like Geist, like consciousness, moves over to Ulkoma, and then understands a different city, a different set of limitations, a different set of things that he can see and must unsee. But then at the end, he moves into a state that is called breach. Now, if you think about it, breach is a noun in this text. It's a verb, and it's an adjective. So the word is working across grammar. It's flowing across grammar. It's doing a lot of work in here. And this state of breach, in some ways, if you think about what he's saying at the end, is like critical thinking. It is, in fact, what we're doing right now, what we've been doing all year, and what you're going to be doing for 3 years at university. You're in breach right now. The point that you began at was your parents' house, that set of limitations that you had there. The next point that you're going to go to is your career, and that set of limitations. And both of those places have things that you're allowed to see and things that you have to unsee. You have this 3-year period, or it could be a 6-year period if you go on to postgraduate work, in which you're in breach. You can see all kinds of things. You can see revolution. You can see different ways of thinking. You can see perversions. You can see sexuality, psychoanalysis, feminism, all these different ways of thinking that may not be allowed in the two cities that you were at. The question is, will you go into the other city and stay there and continue to unsee, or will you stay in breach? Because right now, this breach is allowed. You went to A-levels and you got a little passport that said you can go down that road, which is called university, in which you were allowed to be in between the two cities. What will you do after this? Will you continue to breach and therefore change the world, or will you stay in that one place?
Two very different interpretations of breach. And has consequences for how we read the end of the novel, because, of course, Boileau is... he doesn't beat him, he joins him, right? So what do we make of that?
I just like to say how weird this novel is. Because weird fiction is weird, strange. But weird also stands for westernized, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And in many ways, you could argue that this is a text of it's about uneven development, and there are two cities within a city, and this seems rather grand, but have any of you found yourselves in Cupola Hall? Have any of you found yourselves signing visa documents? Have any of you found yourselves dealing with passport and immigration? Have any of you done a citizenship test? I think this is one of the texts, the interesting part of the text, that is quite, it displays this world that is free in some ways, globalized, the networks, but in another way, it is legislated, it is surveilled, it's controlled, and it is policed. So in that sense, it kind of, I would agree with Joe saying, it breach is an authoritarian power, but I defy anyone to run across a border, because you will get shot. As the poor PhD student gets shot. And if there's probably any argument against a Christian, it is that poor PhD student happily trying to revolt and find special knowledge, while she ends up dead.
A very necessary overlay to the two interpretations we've heard. Okay.
Hi, I wanted to talk about gender in the novel, and then I realized that we are accidentally sitting boy-girl, except that I'm on the wrong side. okay, so I started reading this, and because I'm the center of my own world, I thought the first-person narrator must be a female person. And then we had this long description of the dead woman sprayed naked for like 30 pages or something. I was like, oh, this is not... This isn't even Law and Order SVU. Like, this is a dude, you know? And the dude sees the woman, and he's like, oh, cover up, for God's sake, she must be a hooker. Like, there's this whole thing, and it just kept going, right? So you've got that smart graduate student, like, warning for all of you. She's really smart, she gives a good paper, but she's actually wrong. you know, the men have fooled her, she ends up dead. Then there's Corwi, who's a cop, and she really tries, and she's such a good cop, but she always says boss, and she's never told about the story, she just listens to the orders. And then there's some shadowy women in Breach that come out of the background, and then there are the lovers, right, who play these pivotal roles, but again, they don't know anything. And it was just like, it was one of the most patriarchal worlds I've been in, and again, maybe it's because I'm in the center of my own world, and you know, most of our students are female, so I just thought, like, this is really, I think all the women are probably going to end up dead or just sad in some way, tipping their coffee off to the hero, right? Okay, so that's just out there, because I think at a kind of formal level, what happens often with fantastical fiction and with a lot of these imagined worlds is that they rely upon patriarchy to give us something familiar, right? So you might not understand how seeing and unseeing works, but you know exactly what those relationships are. Oh yeah, and the woman professor, she's supposed to be really smart, but she doesn't have a clue either, right? It's the man who can really do it. I mean, this is the world we kind of live in, okay? And I hope you guys will change it, which is why I encourage you to read differently. Okay, so they rely on these expectations to make it predictable, right? The world of men and women here, these are exactly the men and women that like we are supposed to be and how things are supposed to line up, even if the borders are unclear, and even if Breach might be something that's contested. And so I think that's a question of fiction's intelligibility, and if you guys are interested in kind of crime dramas and stuff, there's like this world of lesbian noir, for instance, or crime shows that happen to have a major female character, like how that changes things. But the other thing I wanted to mention in terms of gender is the whole question of genre fiction. So as you probably know, these kinds of crime dramas, murder mysteries and so forth, are generally associated with male readers and male authors, science fiction as well, whereas romance novels, so-called chick lit, a lot of young adult fantasy novels are usually associated with women writers, certain kinds of fanfic, right? And there's this way in which male genre fiction has been allowed to assume respectability in literary guise in a way that women's genres have not. Right, and I think this is an extremely technically accomplished novel. Right, he takes this kind of predictable whodunit structure and he makes it into something else. He gives it a very original conceit and all this political meaning. Even though we know exactly what genre this is, right? But could you imagine this course ending with a romance novel that did the same thing? Right, it's just—it's kind of beyond the realm of our comprehension. And I think that is really, really important. And you might pay attention to it. If you're interested in these kinds of questions, there's also the. There's lots of stuff online, and anyway, I'll stop.
Yeah, so I'd just like to draw your attention to the drawing on the first two points. The kind of, I think you talked about excavation and the mixture of primitiveness with kind of sophistication. I'd like to draw maybe like China Mirabelle's drawing attention to the artifice of mixing the pulp narrative with the kind of modes of surrealism. And also how that brings into line the kind of whole issue of heteroglossia, which is merging kind of different dialogues within and embedding them within the same narrative. And I'd also just like you to think about, well, the way academia, the way all of us are kind of sent up into in the novel, that we're all open. There is no such thing as objective truth. We're all manipulated. And coerced by political forces in terms of what we write. Even the Orsini, even this radical thing is this kind of political forces that kind of mobilizing. So I'd invite you to think about the way and the references to postmodern thinkers like Foucault and Baudrillard, how all of us are open to being satirized within the novel. So.
Okay, thanks. So I want to just open it up now to you guys if you have questions about any of this, what we've touched on, or points of your own that you'd like to raise. Don't be shy. Because we remain, you know, on the spot. Right? Good for you.
I can't deal with this silence. Emily, do you think the heteroglossia acts as a way to segregate the groups in the city, or do you think it acts as a way to unite and actually come to a resolution at the end of the novel.
Ooh, that's a really interesting point. I mean, I think the way in which language has these social connotations are initially supposed to segregate them, which is why it's so terrible when that guy telephones Baloo from Alcoma and he speaks in Illitan and he always drops the phone because he's like, oh, I'm an accomplice to this kind of transgression, even though it's incredibly difficult to police. And then the mixing of languages, I think, as well. So I think that...
I think, how different are the languages? Because when he's in that phone call, doesn't he say, oh, they're just the bloody same anyway? And it just made me wonder, like, are the languages in the same way as the city?
I think it's largely ideological. The language is supposed to be restrictive, but actually it can be liberating by doing these small transgressions. And I think you're right to draw attention to that, and the fact that everyone seems to be able to speak both anyway, even though they're not supposed to. What do you think? I mean, I think there's a really... No, I think it's a really important point. It's really interesting to discuss, but...
So looking at heteroglossy is kind of like the idea of... polyphonics, isn't it? Multi-voiceness.
Uh-huh.
You've got all the different voices. I don't know, personally, for me, I think it, like you're saying, going on like this whole detective thing, you've got to transgress all the different boundaries, and for me it was the transgression between all those that kind of came to a conclusion at the end. I think without that they wouldn't have been able to find the resolution.
I think it's really interesting as well, because you just reminded me when you said that, the two police forces in the two cities, one's called the Polizia and one's called the Milizia, probably garbled that, but you get my drift. One of them has these connotations of the military, right, and one of them has the connotations of the police. And when Baloo goes to Alcoma and he sees the way that Dap interrogates some kids, he's shocked because he thinks it's really militaristic, essentially, because he kind of smacks them about a little bit. So I think the power of labelling there, I think that kind of feeds into what you're saying, is that the idea of living up to language as well, or choosing not to. Thanks for the point.
It's an extremely crude addition. This seems to me, we talk on English and British Fiction quite a bit about code switching and about the way that the language you speak in a British context attributes certain class identifiers to you. So talk about it in Trainspotting, I won't go into it now. But there seems to be that you could work on the way that language practice in the city and the city maps onto maybe a recognisable class divide within the novel, and also how that maps onto a recognisable metaphorical class divide in the wider world. It seems instructive that the people who speak elite and are the perhaps on the wealthier, more influential side, and the people who speak base are on the downward trajectory culturally.
There's I think another good understanding of that in a city that was brought up earlier by Nick, which is El Paso, Ciudad Juárez, which is where my mother was born. She was born in a city called Ciudad Juárez, which used to go all the way around this river called El Rio Grande. And then in 1848, when a country called the United States invaded Mexico and stole about the top third of Mexico, then they cut the city in half. And the city that my grandmother is from, is Nogales, is also cut in half. But in all of these border towns, Spanish and English is spoken interchangeably. Another semi-border town, Los Angeles, where I'm from, we also speak Spanish and English interchangeably. There's Spanish, there's English, and then there's Spanglish, which is kind of a combination of both. For example, if I were to say, "Watcha me voy a patear el troque," that is a real bad Spanish way of saying, "Watch me, I'm going to park the truck," which should be, "Mira, me voy a estacionar el camión," in Spanish. So you see this huge blending of languages. We see this also with Türkisch going on in Berlin right now, where a lot of the, I know for a fact, a lot of the gangs in Berlin even if they're German-speaking, are starting to bring in Turkish dialect into their German, into their Deutsch. And probably we have tons of examples of this kind of language blending going on everywhere.
But I think it's important to hold on to the perspective, because it's not fronted by the sort of the gritty, serious realist nature of the novel. That this is all close to a child's game. You know, remember how children have to learn not to see the other city and the other inhabitants, and we sort of gradually come to be aware that actually it is just one city, and this entire structure of division and of non-seeing and of, you know, the kind of cultural taboos and national myths of origin that arise from this is all grown-up world make-believe, effectively. And this is very much like, you know, walking through Coventry, walking through Leamington, and pretending that it's really two cities, but it's actually just the one.
This might be like way off the point, so I apologize if it is, but I was just thinking about two ideas of this, in a sense of the imposition of authority as a subconscious, and also the point about masculinity and patriarchy, and kind of extrapolating that from a novel and bringing it into kind of like a modern context and looking at something like the House of Parliament. And I was thinking, you know, if you look at the vast majority of the House of Parliament, if not the front bench particularly, you see this kind of unspoken rule. These people have to be already in power before they get to power. They have to be male, as they can't get in. There's no written rules to suggest that. There's nothing that tells us as a society that as someone working class and female, you can't get into politics. But there is almost that imposition of these kind of structures that do stop that. And I think that's what worries me when I read these kinds of books, that all right, it's fictional, look at it. But when we take a look at it and look at the House as a Parliament, that almost does seem like a city within a city that's kind of cordoned off from the class population around it, and that's it, kind of elite, kind of part of society.
Were you going to talk about the University of Warwick in terms of Britishism?
Well, I rant and rant and rant about the paralysis and stasis in the British constitutional settlement and how that perfectly maps onto it. But I won't. Yeah. I'm always talking about that. Warwick as a space.
Yeah.
Well, one of the ways in which we can see the other side of the dialectic of what I was talking about is that at a university, one of the things they do is they keep radicals. Because what I would like to do is overthrow capitalism. I would like to see no countries. I would like to see no governments. I would like to see simply people. But if I was out there on the street doing that, I would be quite dangerous. Instead, they put me in here. They pay me. I talk to you guys for 3 years. And then, no damage has been done. So the other way of thinking about the university and critical thinking as a way of being liberating is that this time-structured liberation is also its inverse. It's the ultimate oppression. The government has finally figured out a way to shut the radicals up. You know.
Is that how we want to read the end of the novel? Again, sorry for the plot spoiling, but the fact that Borloo becomes Breach, that's a intrinsically ambiguous point on which to end.
Shutting him up, he's liberated, and that's enough for him. That was interesting. That by one person being granted to be able to see both and to understand, it stopped any other repercussions they could have. There's no chance of him shooting someone down an alleyway again, reaching in front of people. He's already there.
So he's been really sterilized. It's not that he's actually reached this room, so wrong. He's been sterilized, he's been quarantined away from where he can do damage, and now he's been incorporated into the...
I mean, that would be true if only she breached,
mm-hmm.
right, and nobody else breached. But what would happen if what I suggested at the end of the Mother Courage lecture, which is that we all followed Catherine's drum, right? And this is one of the issues about organization. If only one person rebels, you're done, you're dead, you're killed, right? Or you can go into the university system. But what if everybody rebelled? What if everybody stopped unseen? Then Breach would become the world. It would become the natural way of being. And that is called a revolution.
Yeah.
I just wanted to respond actually to what you said, which I thought was really important. And I mean, I have to say, so that kind of the naturalization of authority is looking a certain way, right? And I mean, I worry about that a lot because what university does to class and to racial privilege is a little bit less clear in terms of it seems to just reproduce it. But what it does to gender is really problematic in that you'll see this achievement gap where the students who are the highest achievers right through their educations are not the highest achievers 20 years later, right? And there's something that's happening in between there. And so just talking about this revolutionary potential of the university, I literally worry a lot about how do I make sure that you guys keep doing what you're doing here after you leave. And I think that problem is kind of inherent in the book's notion of what authority looks like, but it's also, I mean, it's very clear if you look at the fact that Breach is told, if we're told that Breach is, there are no children in Breach, right? Now, if there are no children in Breach, that means that, and if the university is Breach, which I think that the Oxford-Cambridge model is, it's all about people who are non-reproductive, or at least are not doing the work of parenting. So, in a way, I mean, there are no mothers in Breach, right? And that's important, right? If you think about the ways in which that role is forced onto certain people, what leadership looks like, what counts and what doesn't as rebellion, right? As useful social work, I think that's really an unresolved issue. Yeah.
Yep.
Sorry. I was just going to ask, like, what you thought about the representation of the unificationists, because obviously they kind of go against this division of the cities. But I found that they were kind of represented to be kind of lunatics, and they weren't accepted, and kind of criminals in a sense. So I don't know, but obviously that's what you were saying about if we all rebelled, but then there is that kind of part in the book where they sort of do, and that happens. So I don't know, what did you think about them?
Well, remember that the rebellion in the book was, one of its functions was that the government set up this false Breach so that other stuff could go on. And that goes on all the time in our world today. It's much more complicated than just simply, you know, the rebels and the authority, you know, because the authority uses rebellion as a way to have us look over there, and then the oppression's going on over here. So you want to look up the concept of repressive desublimation by Marcuse to understand that. So that's one answer to that.
But they are presented in two quite different ways. Fringe radicals, you know, crazies, and then also utopians of a pretty deep dye.
I'm afraid I can't quite remember who said about it, but somebody covered the topic of the two cities being like the self and other. I was wondering what you think about, say, seeing the two cities in a more psychoanalytic sense and seeing them in like today's capitalist society in which, you know, the idea of individualism and laissez-faire and ignoring other people to get ahead, whether the book could be seen in that way.
Psychoanalysis. I'm not sure exactly how you would want to use psychoanalysis in this way. Okay, this is my take on the novel. You could possibly read it in a different way, but I think what the novel is doing here is to foreground, okay, because we've been talking about Breach, right? So for me, I think in order to understand what Breach means, we have to look at how it responds to the crime that's at the center of the novel. And the crime at the center of the novel is a kind of transgression that is not technically breaching. So what Mahalia does is to take some of the artifacts and then she puts them into a crosshatch spot land, some piece of land, right? And then someone else comes and takes the artifacts and sells them. So Bess takes those artifacts and sells the artifacts to a transnational corporation whose nationality is unclear, right? Sierra and Core. So Breach, I think, need not be understood only in very negative terms as like state repression or on the other extreme, like extremely positive terms, it represents liberation. It seems to be a kind of counteracting force to the way in which transnational capitalism does not respect national boundaries. And I don't think the text necessarily supports wholeheartedly the reinforcement of national boundaries, neither does it suggest that we should, you know, just be open to everybody else. So that's why the detective plays this kind of dual role. He both transgresses boundaries, but he also reinforces boundaries. Yes, and then as for the two cities, being self and other, I guess what I was trying to get at was to say that the relationship between those two cities, if you look at the crime itself, right, what's happening, how does the crime connect the two cities, it's not an obvious case of like Ves is exploiting Ukoma's resources or something like that. It's a lot more unstable, because Ukoma is supposed to be previously less economically affluent than Ves, but then now it's rising, and then Ves seems to be on decline, but Ves is also trying to do the exact same things that Ukoma is doing, right? Try to invite foreign investments. So I think what the novel is doing is to show us how different geographical and cultural spaces and social spaces in the world are connected by transnational capitalism, but not necessarily in ways that are easy to reduce into like dichotomies, mannequin dichotomies.
I'll say a word on psychoanalysis. Simply what unseeing is from a psychoanalytic point of view is repression, is when you repress a desire. That's unseen. And breach, in a way, could be seen as the mental health establishment. If you refuse to repress, and then you start acting in a way that looks different than the other people who are repressing, you are now considered to be schizophrenic or mentally ill, taken out of society, sometimes forcibly, and placed in this location called the mental hospital. And in many ways, the place that the characters were in, that was called Breach, looked very much like a mental hospital. You know, some of the ways that they were described, even the uniforms that were worn by the institutional space, yes.
I'd invite you to think about comparing that to Lujan's text as well, where, you know, everybody, he's insane because he's critiquing the very structures of within society, mm-hmm. patriarchal structures, and when he suddenly accepts them, and when he is co-opted, just like the man who, just like Baloo in Breach, he's sudden that everything's okay for him again.
Exactly. In the back.
When you said something about humans breaching and animals breaching all the time, mm. I was wondering if you thought that animals could breach, or like pieces of detritus or whatever could breach, because it seems to me that like breach relies mm-hmm. on human sort of sense of fear and of looking up to it, and that the characters in this text who are human look at physical characteristics and unsee them as a sort of excuse to as an excuse for ideology. They see the buildings, but what it really is they're seeing ideology and then unseeing it and focusing on their own. So I was wondering if like you had any comments on that.
Page 112. Pigeons, mice, wolves, bats live in both cities, are cross-hatched animals. Of course, there's a whole eco reading that you could give to the novel that plays on precisely that kind of habituated transgression that animals always fall into with respect to humanly constructed boundaries. And again, it draws into sharp relief the kinds of constructions that structure the divisions in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I misspoke when I said that animals breach, because of course, as I tried, the point I was trying to make was that breach is this fundamental social agreement, if you like, a consensus. So animals can't breach, as you, I think, articulated very nicely there. And that it also feeds into the way that the cities are divided in a kind of meaningful spatial way, but only to the extent that those spaces are given social values, political values. So water cross-hatches, this strange description of the way that water transgresses these boundaries. Of course, the material world is ignorant of breach and insensible to breach, and yet when we conceive of the process of breaching, we can superimpose that process on the material world, as it were, much like the building.
Husserl would like to make another intertextual reference, and in a way this novel takes us back right to Faust, because if you think about it, Faust was this liminal space between kind of enlightenment, modernity, but yet it's appended with the kind of, you know, superstitious but magical rationalism. And this novel is doing very much the same thing, isn't it? It's a return to something that was, in certain ways, something that was written 200 years before.
And it,
I think that the intertextual links that you can draw from The City and the City to other syllabus texts very productive and testify as to why it is, I think, an appropriate text that finishes the course with. A couple that I jotted down was the obsession with the bureaucratic, so it connects to Kafka in that respect, and also Kafka's literalization of the metaphor. So the metamorphosis is about actually becoming vermin, not just being vermin in a metaphorical sense, but becoming vermin. The City and the City addresses our ideas of what it is to live in cities that are divided, but literalizes that division. Here are two cities occupying the same space.
In my opinion, one of the greatest literary breachers is William Shakespeare. Shakespeare breaches every genre. Every play that he writes can be a comedy and a tragedy simultaneously. He's cross-dressing his characters. He gives his females power in a way that no other author at that time is doing. He's breaching Islamic people, he's breaching Jewish people. All of these people are constantly breaching in his place. And if you think about it, that was the last real revolution that we had. It was called the Renaissance.
Something to look forward to? Okay, I think we have time for one more.
My sort of question is just a point about the Shakespeare thing, but like in the book, I would say that Shakespeare always puts society back, like at the end of Midsummer Night's like, Dream, they go back out of the woods after being in the, I don't know whether it's kind of, it's sort of doing the same thing, showing you what breach is, but then you get used to it and you comply with it.
Except what were they watching at the marriage, at the wedding? What was the play that was put on? Pyramus and Thisbe, an Ovidian tragedy. Even when you think you're getting a comedic ending, Shakespeare's throwing that tragedy in there. He's saying, remember. And what changes the play, the juice, is the blood of Pyramus and Thisbe. It comes from tragedy. The comedy came from tragedy.
Okay, sorry. Ben?
Can I just make a point about breach? I think that when you, because we've talked about breach so much, but one of the things I just kind of was thinking about, that breach only exists if there's a social structure established in which there are positive things and negative things. So, like, breach only operates to the extent that it's a seeing and an unseeing at the same time, because if there can't be a breach of something if there is not a moral structure or a kind of, I don't know what I want to say, like an establishment
political
setup.
Yeah.
And it's just something that I was bursting to say.
Thank you. Anyone last?
Can I bring it back to what you were saying about the role of women? Because I thought, like, you had some really great points that you probably didn't have time to analyse them. I was wondering what you thought about the central murder and whether it could be construed as misogynistic, of like this kind of killing off of this strong, bright female who's like seen the flaws in his ideas, and whether that is like a central kind of he can't be proved wrong, and like patriarchal structure of his knowledge being superior can't be proved wrong.
True, I think that's a great reading. I mean, it's interesting though, because on the one hand you have the villain who is manipulating women for his own purposes, but you also have the hero manipulating women for his own purposes. I think we are in a thoroughly patriarchal world. I mean, and because this novel seems to be set at least vaguely in our present or maybe in our future, women are still educated and have jobs, but they're not agents in any way. I don't know if you guys would disagree with that. I mean, and a lot of the novel, so, well, the murder. The fact that when you see a naked woman dumped out of a van, you assume that she's a prostitute and not a victim is just, like, that is, like, sexism 101. But anyway, I mean, that's, like, the opening conceit. And then a lot of it rests on this idea that she might have made a departure, right? That she was a smart girl who might have come up with something. Her friend believes her, right? That she's invented something, like, she's found something real. But then we're told that, don't worry, that's not actually what's going on. Does that answer your... Yeah.
And even when she discovers what's happened, she doesn't doubt his bad intentions, you know what I mean? That she still is co-opted into thinking that actually he was misled, right? That the structures of patriarchal knowledge, there's something well-intentioned in it. She was deluded into thinking that from the beginning, yeah.
Okay, thank you. We're over time, but I just wanted to end by thanking you all for the year, because without you, this module does not exist, and you've been great students.